We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyreek Evans.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the New Orleans Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Pelicans finished a 1-2 week, falling back to 500 after having gotten a little bit above 500 after the Oklahoma City win. Tonight, to talk about those games and a little bit about some of the players on the team, is Mason Ginsberg. Mason, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. So we'll talk a little about the games, but before we get to the games, there are some people, I always listen to Zach Lowe. Zach Lowe is phenomenal. His podcasts are great. He's been saying this recently. I want to get your take if it matters, if it doesn't matter, or if is it even true. But Zach has been basically saying that he feels that the Western Conference playoff lineup is set, that pretty much already any team that didn't make it last year is out. His assumption is that the Oklahoma City Thunder will continue their role that they're on right now and move back into the top eight, pushing Phoenix and New Orleans and Sacramento back down to the bottom. So first, do you think should they just throw in the towel?
It's hard to disagree with him just because of what we've seen so far. And obviously the major caveat here is injuries. So barring, any major injury for any of those teams, it's really tough to argue that, the Pelicans can leapfrog anyone. Obviously when OKC gets Durant back, assuming those guys stay healthy, they're one of probably the best four teams in the Western Conference. So you have to figure they're going to climb back in because they're only a couple games out right now. The Spurs, obviously they've had pretty much New Orleans injury luck so far this season. So while they're the closest team to catch otherwise than the other top six, I hate to be a pessimist, but it's hard to disagree with Zach Lowe about this. Ultimately with a division, with a conference this strong, it's going to come down to injuries if people can stay healthy.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with it. I want to be positive, and it's possible that the Pelicans will start going on a run, and it's possible they can keep that run going through the rest of the season, but they're 15-15 right now. That means that they're going to be fighting with teams like the Clippers and San Antonio and Dallas to get into the playoffs. And I just have a feeling all those teams are going to win at like a 60% rate through the rest of the season at worst. So the Pelicans are going to have to win at a 65% rate to pass them And that's pretty difficult to do, especially when you're in the Western Conference and you're playing those teams.
Yeah, I mean, and you can look at the strength of schedule too, and point to the Pelicans have the number two hardest strength of schedule in the league, and Phoenix right now, who they play on Tuesday, a big game, is their bottom five. So I think the Pelicans will pass Phoenix. I think they are comfortably. This could be a little bit of homerism, but I think they are comfortably the ninth best team in the Western Conference. But it's tough.
Yep. So I was doing a little bit of a game in my head, and I was looking down the Western Conference, and I was trying to figure out, okay, let's just say we could curse one player from any of those teams, and the next game, ACL's torn up for the rest of the season. Let's say we're being real bastards about it. So look down that list and tell me, what player on what team you would eliminate for the season with an eye to getting the New Orleans Pelicans into the playoffs? Who's got to go down?
So are we removing Durant from this equation? Because I feel like he's the obvious choice at this point. Am I wrong?
Let's remove Durant from the equation.
Okay.
So anybody above them right now. So
okay.
Ignore Oklahoma City.
Okay. That's interesting. If you're looking, I don't know. I want to pick Duncan first, but San Antonio is going to be tough either way with Pop. So, and it could be one of the two bigs in Dallas. It could be either Tyson Chandler or Dirk. Maybe Dirk's a better player, but Tyson may be the guy they need to stay healthy because the defense might fall apart without him. So, it might be somebody from Dallas. Ugh, it's everyone's so good. Maybe Aldridge. I know Portland's in second right now, but they're really thin after that starting lineup. So. I don't know. I'd have to think a little more, but off the top of my head, maybe Aldridge or one of the two bigs in Dallas. What do you think?
So my initial target was Steph Curry.
Okay.
I really think Golden State's offense would grind badly if he went down, but I think they're so far ahead, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like even if that makes them win 500 the rest of the way, they're 19 games over 500 right now.
Yeah, and their defense has been what's carrying them, I think, though. Their top five defense, and I mean, assuming that Bogut's healthy, like that's even without Curry, that's still a very, very strong defense.
Right. Essentially, you'd be playing a Chicago team in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually going Houston and take out James Harden.
Okay.
So
what you mean more shots for Josh Smith?
More shots for Josh Smith, but it's also like he is the engine of that team. Like if he goes down, who is creating shots for that team? It's not Dwight Howard. It's not Josh Smith.
Yeah, and they're thin. They're thin at the guard position too.
So right, I mean Patrick Beverley is a good player, but I wouldn't want him trying to figure out what to do with the ball. So I think I would have to go in Houston, take out our buddy James Harden. I gave some consideration to the Clippers and, hitting Blake Griffin, just because I hate Blake Griffin more than I think that would actually cause him to fall out of the race. But, I think it would have an impact and it would be satisfying to see Blake Griffin miss a season. But, that's just me being vindictive.
Yeah. So I like the Houston pick. I want kind of like Golden State. I think their defense with, now Josh Smith will help them on that end. So we have Howard, Ariza, Beverly. And so I think they'd still be a solid defensive team without Harden, but it's a good call. And I think he's one of the five for sure.
Right. And like right now, if you just look at like point differentials, Houston is the worst of the top seven teams. I mean, if we're not talking Phoenix, Oklahoma City and New Orleans, Houston is the weakest. They're only got a point differential of 3.6, and it's because their defense is really good, but their offense is actually pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have James Harden and his efficient scoring, that offense is just – you're just done. So, I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah.
So your prediction is the New Orleans Pelicans will be sitting outside looking in at the end of the season?
Yeah, I mean, without any other injuries and assuming Durant's back pretty soon. It's just, even though the strength of schedule gets easier, it's hard to, and I'm not saying they have a 10% chance of making the playoffs because there is a decent chance that of those top teams, someone important goes down and that makes their percentage chance of getting into the playoffs higher. But you know, it's hard to say with any sort of real confidence that they're going to get in at this point.
All right. So next question, which is the inevitable follow-up. New Orleans does not make the playoffs this year. Is that a disappointment? And if it is a disappointment, should Monty be shown the door? Because that's pretty much where everybody is. Like, there's a lot of people out there who think Monty is the major problem. I don't necessarily buy it, but if they do fail to make the playoffs this year, should Monty take the blame for that, or is he just coaching a team that probably doesn't have enough talent to reach the playoffs?
So that's a difficult question because I don't think you should grade Monty based on whether or not this Pelicans team makes the playoffs, because it's just, that's kind of what we just talked about. It's a gauntlet. The whole freaking conference it's so hard. And I mean, you look at the Pelicans, they'd be fighting for a home first round playoff series. I firmly believe that in the Eastern Conference. Like, it's just tough. I mean, there's a lot of things you can, you know, gripe about with Monty, but I don't think whether or not they make the playoffs should be what keeps them or shows in the door.
Okay. How about Dell?
Dell
does die. I mean, you don't see a whole lot of people complaining about Dell, but this is the team he built, and it may be finished. It may not be finished. I have a feeling that he has more moves planned, definitely, and this is a work of progress. But how much rope do you give Dell at this point?
Yeah, I tend to give him a little more than others, I think. I agree with you. I think he's got more stuff coming. But, I mean, if you look at, for example, the trade they made this past offseason, getting Omar Asik, right now it doesn't look great if you just look at the raw numbers. I mean, I think what he does to help with Anthony Davis and open up the game for AD at the power forward position is immense. But, you know, the defense has still been pretty bad this year, and you traded another first-round pick for it. So that could be something that you lump on top of, you know, whether or not you think the moves he's made in the past are good or not. You know, that's another thing you can question about him. So, you know, I don't think the playoffs should be a determining factor for either of those two guys, just because of, you know, missing the playoffs isn't an indication of how, you know, not being a good team in the Western Conference.
Yeah. If you were Vivek Ranadive, though, I think Monty would have been fired about five times by now.
Oh, what's that?
If you were Ranadive of Sacramento.
Yeah.
Wow.
And his replacement maybe gets fired by now, too.
Right. So let's move on from the depressing news that we don't think New Orleans is going to actually make the playoffs here. But we did see Eric Gordon is cropping up in various places. And the team is hopefully going to be seeing him back on the court soon. You put up a post recently on the site. If you guys haven't read it, you should pop onto the site and take a look at it. We have enough minutes now that we could pretty definitively tell what's the net impact of taking Eric Gordon out of the lineup and inserting Luke Babbitt as a starting small forward. So Mason, how bad is it? Does it matter?
It's not good. I kind of just threw this piece together. You know, it's like 600 words. I threw it together in like an hour or so yesterday, just because I did a little digging, and it's, you know, we know Eric Gordon wasn't playing great for the Pelicans while he was on the court, but, you know, as a member of that starting lineup with Tyreek, Drew, and AD and Omer, they were excellent. They were plus, I think, 12 points per 100 possessions, which is among lineups with 140 minutes or more. It was sixth best in the NBA. And so, like, it still is. There's two Clipper lineups ahead of them, and I'm sure one of Golden State's lineups are there. I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, it's the difference has been jaw-dropping. They're minus 9 and minus 10 points per 100 possessions with Luke Babbitt in the lineup. So, I don't know. I think you have enough minutes now where Babbitt has been hitting three-pointers. He just hasn't been shooting a ton of them. And what he's done for the offense hasn't been that drastic to help. And the defense has been pretty bad, too.
Yeah. Yeah, poor Babbitt. I mean, the guy is a small forward with the speed of a power forward. I don't see him really being any better than like the seventh or eighth guy in any rotation. He's just not good enough. And that's kind of the running theme with this entire team. And it's you know, one I was kind of hoping we'd come into the season and have a bench that actually can go out there and you know, protect leads or even extend them. But the team's bench, Austin Rivers, is up and down so badly and more down than up, I would say. And other than Ryan Anderson, who basically plays a starter's minutes, this is a really thin team. And I don't see if they have really the assets to fix that. They can't trade for, I mean, there's like, I always like try to play the game. Like, what small forward could come in and actually impact this team beneficially? And you end up with like Wilson Chandler and Jeff Green, but what do you offer those teams? Like, we have no draft pick.
Yeah. So it's tough. And honestly, it's kind of funny that the bench has kind of been what's getting us back into games after the starting lineup kind of screws us up. But that's, you know, that's like you said, we're playing a bench player to replace Eric Gordon right now in Luke Babbitt. And I think that the Dante Cunningham acquisition is really, it really hasn't been praised enough, because he's added a lot to this team. And I think that, well, that's what I talked about in the piece, was kind of swapping out Cunningham for Babbitt. And you know, I realize that Cunningham's game probably fits better with an Anderson-Davis pairing than Davis and Oshik. But, you know, I think he just adds more on both sides of the ball, you know, apart from he doesn't shoot threes, but he's shooting 50% or higher on the, you know, mid-range jumpers, which, you know, he can space the floor to an extent, maybe not all the way out to the three-point line. But I think he'd help and bring more to the team, especially defensively, than we get from Babbitt.
I'll be 100% honest. Dante annoys me in the same way that Jason Smith does. And it's that I just have a really hard time believing that 2 to 3 feet can make that big of a difference in your shooting percentage. Like, if you take that extra step, like stride backwards and shoot from there, is your shooting percentage going to drop from like 48% down to what? Like, even if it drops 20%, you're still getting way better results overall. Well, that's not actually accurate mathematically, but 15%. If it drops 15%, and is a stride really 15% worse? Are you that? I can't imagine that Dante can be that good a step inside the 3-point line, but be terrible if he stepped behind the 3-point line.
Yeah. And what you get from Babbitt is essentially a guy that camps out in the corner all possession to shoot a corner three. And do we really think that, as you're saying, Cunningham couldn't knock down that shot, not with the consistency that Babbitt can, but he could be a threat there. You have to guard a guy that shoots that well. As you said, just take one step back. Like, I hear you on that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's actually roll to the games.
Okay.
The Pelicans lost in probably my most enraging, infuriating, annoying game of the season. They lost in Indiana 96-84. And then they went to San Antonio and won. Of course, San Antonio was missing a couple of players, but, you know, still going to San Antonio. It was at home in San Antonio. And then they went to Chicago the next night. So let's talk about this horrible Indiana game. I actually feel bad because Nick and I, in the last podcast, which is why Nick was not invited back, it's entirely his fault. We talked about how we were not fearful whatsoever of the Indiana Pacers. No one here who scares us. They're a joke, blah, blah, blah. And then, holy cow, 39% from the field, 20% from three. They only got 19 free throws, and they didn't even shoot them that well. 15 turnovers. The team couldn't get out of their own way. So, looking at this squad, whose fault is it? Who are you going to blame?
Man, it was just people, guys missed shots. I covered, this is a game I covered, and it's, you know, the issue, the defense looked bad if you look at the some of the numbers, but, you know, a lot of it was you miss shots, your defense is out of position. They get, Indiana scored more, fast break points. They pretty much doubled up their season average. They're one of the fewest fast, low scoring teams on the fast break per game in the league. And they, Pelicans missed shots. They got out and running, which they don't do terribly often. And, you know, they made the Pelicans pay for those missed shots. You know, Anderson obviously was ice cold, missed all six of his threes. You know, Babbitt actually had a good shooting game, but like, it didn't take many, 3 for 5 from beyond the arc. No, just
it's not often you're going to see Jrue Holiday miss 5 3-pointers in a game either.
Yeah, 0-for-11 between Jrue and Ryan, pretty much unheard of. So that was that was tough.
Yeah. So I mean, I watched it and it was just like, you know, Indiana, their job, like their entire identity is just to muck it up and make you take shots you don't want to and play a little tough and for Luis Scola to fling his hair around. And I mean, it was not only a loss, but the whole game, you're just like, oh, come on, guys.
Yeah.
Like, you should be able to beat this. Like, Tariq, you can get to the basket at will again for most of these guys. And he could get there, but he wasn't really doing anything.
Yep. The Roy Hibbert effect, he controlled the paint. It's the concern you would have going into that game with guys like Jrue and Tariq, who love to get to attack the rim, but you know, you got a guy like Roy Hibbert there, who's the rim protector that he is, 7'2", and he's just, you know, changing shots, and it worked. And the open shots the Pelicans did get, they didn't make, so very frustrating.
Yep, and they're only your best counter to that is hitting your 3-point shots and making Roy Hibbert have to come out of the game.
Yep.
And they weren't doing it. So before we torture ourselves anymore, let's just move on. And again, I think we have to again blame Nick, because last podcast we just talked about how wonderful Jrue was, and then he goes out and has a 7-of-21 game. So it's definitely a curse.
Yep.
San Antonio, though, much different game, much happier result.
Yep.
I mean, it doesn't matter to me if Tony Parker doesn't play and Leonard doesn't play. It's just good to be able to beat the Spurs and to be able to see Anthony Davis play that well against a really good team. But I have to give the game ball to Jrue Holiday in this one. I just felt like Jrue, and again, you look at his stat line and it's not that impressive, but whoever they turned him loose on the perimeter, they weren't able to do stuff. Like, they had him guarding Manu Ginobili for the first half and Manu couldn't get it going. And then they switched him off and they had him on Marco because Marco had been, you know, going off. Mm-hmm. And suddenly Manu started hitting shots. So it's just, I would love to see this team with two competent guards on the defensive end. Any chance Eric Gordon is one of those?
probably not. Judging by the past season of data, you know, it doesn't look like that's terribly likely, but you know, he's not. I don't think he's. I also don't think he's as bad as this. As the, like the real plus minus numbers had him at last year. But
yeah,
you
know. Yeah. Last year they had him as the worst defensive player or guard in the entire league.
Yep.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
I can't imagine he's that bad.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think so either.
All right. So you talked a little bit when we were talking about whose leg would you sweep, and. You know, if Tim Duncan wasn't playing this game, the San Antonio Spurs didn't have a chance. I mean, I'm 100% certain of that. Do you think that Tony Parker and Kawhi Leonard could pick up the slack enough for if Tim Duncan went down?
I think they might be able to, but I mean, that's almost as much as a function of the system that Greg Popovich has. That, you know, if you think about the game that the Pelicans won in San Antonio like a month ago or a month and a half, whenever it was, they won by 1 point, and the Spurs second unit played the entire fourth quarter pretty much. And so that just kind of speaks to the depth and how well defined each player's role is for the Spurs. So, you know, I say Tim Duncan because I think on defensively he's the thing that really keeps the Spurs you know, as a very solid defensive team. Even with Kawhi's a stopper, obviously on the perimeter, but you know, Tim Duncan's defense has been excellent this year, and that's kind of why I picked Duncan for them. But you know, they're just such a deep team and such a well-oiled machine, so to speak.
Yeah, you're supposed to say no, they would flounder and fall apart, and we can just write off the Spurs because we've been doing that for 3 years and 4 years, actually probably longer than that. I feel like we've been seeing that the Spurs are bound to fall apart like since like 2008 or 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's just crazy that Tim Duncan, he had a 20-11 in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was Anthony Davis's average last year, and we were all super excited about it.
Yep.
All right, and then Chicago Bulls. Now, I'm not upset by this game whatsoever. It's second out of back-to-back. You had to fly to Chicago to play it. When you were watching this, though, am I stupid in saying that I think Jimmy Butler is the best two-way shooting guard in the entire league right now?
Oof, he's good. I mean, he's obviously he'd be a dream target for New Orleans, but he's a restricted free agent and he's gonna get max. Like I feel like there's no way around that. I mean, he's staying in Chicago, but he's impressive. And you know what? He was the last pick in the first round, right? That's where he was drafted. Mm-hmm. It's just it's insane what he's done and where he's come from to be such a strong player on both ends. And you know, assuming Tibbs doesn't run him into the ground, well. Even though he probably will. I mean, that Butler, what he does for how many minutes a night that he plays is on both. Like, he doesn't, no plays off for him. And that's just incredibly impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would put him in the same category as James Harden and Klay Thompson. And I would take Jimmy Butler. I would have a hard time taking him over James Harden because mm-hmm. Harden's so efficient. Yep. But, and Butler has great defense compared to Harden, but, you know, I'd probably go James Harden, number one shooting guard in the league. But Butler's number two, and that makes – I think he's the best two-way, but he gives you both ends. And they were running this play in the last quarter over and over again just to try to get Butler to be switched on to one of two players that they knew he could take so that either he was being guarded by Ryan Anderson, in which case he would try to get by him, or he was being guarded by Drew Holiday, and he would post up Holiday. And Holiday is a phenomenal defender. Like against, we see him pulling the rug out from under power forwards all the time, mm-hmm. poking the ball away. He's really good at guarding guys bigger than him, just with his speed and anticipation. Mm-hmm. And he had no answers for Butler. Mm-hmm. Butler just backed him down. If Drew tried to pull the rug out from under him, he would get a nice little spin and a layup. He was completely under control the whole time, and it was the first time I felt like Drew could not handle a player he was being set up against. And I mean, I can't say much higher than that that praise for Jimmy.
Yeah, there's such an impressive talent. Like I said, coming out of it's not often you see a guy do what he's doing from where he was drafted. You know, like obviously you have your Manu Ginobili's every now and then in the second round. You know, Chandler Parsons, guys like that. But you know. Butler's looking like it's hard. I'm trying to put him a top. He's top X player in the NBA right now. What would you say for Butler?
I would say top 15.
Wow. And see, that's just incredible. I mean, is there any other player in the top 15 that was taken anywhere outside of the top 10 in the draft?
No, probably. I mean, there might be a couple guys in the low teens, but yeah, I can't think of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, even more. I mean, the most interesting line I thought about this entire thing was Derrick Rose was a complete afterthought on that team. Like, he would get the ball every so often, but they weren't running plays for him. He was the off guy. And he was hitting jumpers that normally I'd be fine taking. But, you know, he took 18 shots and scored 19 points, which has always been his thing. But you could just look at his assist totals. The guy wasn't driving to the basket. He wasn't – I mean, he had two four-ways to the hoop. He's a complete – just, you know, complimentary player at this point. And it's just amazing this team is as good offensively as they are with Derrick Rose not rounding into any real form.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Powell's helped them. Powell's been pretty efficient since he since he joined Chicago. And
he must have hated LA. Like, I can't read that as anyway, but. He was, I mean, because he looked so done in L.A. the last year when I was watching him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, every once in a while he'd have, like, an offensive outburst, but he was not trying defensively even slightly. And offensively, he wasn't, like, working real hard. And he comes to a real team, and suddenly he's pretty impressive. Though, I will say, Ashik did a really good job on Pau Gasol. I got to say that because people are going to kill Ashik because he missed – point-blank layup mm-hmm. after point-blank layup getting blocked.
Yep.
But I mean, he did keep Pau Gasol when he was on the court for those 20 minutes he got to play.
Yep.
He kept Pau Gasol well away from the basket and was only taken to the hoop and scored on one time.
Yeah. And I think that people may look at that and say, oh, Pau Gasol, he's past his prime, and it's not that difficult to do. But if you look at the numbers, just don't bear that out. Pau Gasol's having a great year. And for Omar Asik to be able to do that was, it was a very solid defensive game for him.
Yep. So I do have one question. I don't know if you have any sort of answer for this. I certainly don't. Do you feel like Ryan Anderson, they're really struggling to get him open on the perimeter?
That's a tough question. I think I've heard concerns brought up about him not being back to full health yet, which I think is fair. Maybe he doesn't have his legs back for the same shooting efficiency that he's been, that he's had from beyond the arc for his whole career. But I feel like the numbers, looking at some of the player tracking data on how many shots have been open for him, I feel like he still had a pretty decent number of open shots. But, it's something I have to go back and research a little more.
Yeah, just for some reason, it feels to me like he's only ever really open if he's taking a shot when he's an extra 2 or 3 feet back from the line, or if there's been like a complete and utter breakdown somewhere, which always happens once or twice in a game. No one has a perfect defensive plan, or there's a transition moment where two people pick up the wrong guy or whatever. But it feels like they have to work so hard to get him open on the perimeter, because every team is just saying, Ryan Anderson is in, just stay on him. And there isn't enough threats elsewhere on the floor, I guess, to make people have to help off of. I mean, maybe that's the answer why Eric Gordon helps his team so much.
Yep.
is he's just another guy who you've got to honor.
Yep.
Even if he's playing poorly, he could stop playing poorly at any moment.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And, I compare, even with Anderson, even if he's not getting open to the same frequency as before, I compare it kind of like to there was a game for the Saints this year where Jimmy Graham had no catches, but the Saints, I think it was the Steelers game, and they won handily. The offense played great. But so when you have someone following around Ryan Anderson that way and making sure he can't get open, that opens up the rest of the offense and other guys can do more things as a result, especially when you've got another big man coming out to guard Anderson. That's not always the case. You'll have switches and he'll be guarded by, maybe a guy a few inches shorter, but still, up on him pretty close. But I think that even if he's not getting open as much, it's still going to help the rest of the offense.
So the only other thing I wanted to say about this game, 46 minutes between John Salmons, Dante Cunningham, and Luke Babbitt. Two shots, 0 points, and exactly 4 rebounds to go with 3 turnovers. I mean, there is not a team in the league who has a worse small forward situation.
Not close.
Than the Pelicans.
Not even close.
I would take even like Philadelphia small forward situation.
Oh, no question.
So, no. Oh.
Yeah, and I mean Cunningham's playing a little out of position too. Like
he is.
I think he can defend the small forward position fairly competently, but there's no denying that he's playing at least a little out of position. But he's one of the more talented players on the team now, and he's got to get minutes somewhere.
Yep. Okay, so let us move on. We have one other article that you posted earlier this week. And I wanted you to give us a little bit of an overview of what's in it, because I am completely torn about Tyreke Evans. Like, I am 100%, I have no idea if Tyreke Evans is actually a positive or a minus for this team. I lean towards positive, because he can get where he wants to on the floor. He can sometimes get to the paint and score. Even if he's not, he's usually leaving it in such a way that there's a chance for an offensive rebound. But he's not drawing free throws anymore. His true shooting percentage is abysmal. He just doesn't get enough free throws. He doesn't hit enough threes. He's just, I have a real hard time figuring out, is he actually positive or negative? And you went through a whole mess of game video of Mr. Evans. So
that's not what you do on Christmas?
No. No, it's not, though. I might just have to go do it, because I'm sure it's the most exciting thing in the world. I'll probably do it for Anthony Davis, though, so at least I'll feel good when I'm done with it.
Yeah.
So, Evans, Why is he not getting any free throws? You always hear people say he gets no respect. Is it a respect issue or is it something else?
So it's hard to really compare it to prior seasons because I don't have that much time. I didn't look at the data from past years. But first things first, you know, his numbers between this season and last season, it really seems like the only difference is the free throw volume. And, you know, everything's pretty close to where he was last year, and he's still getting to the rim a ton. He's third most drives per game in the league, behind just Michael Carter Williams and Ty Lawson. And so the only difference, it seems like he's not getting as many free throws. So, you know, at first it has seemed like the refs haven't given him the respect he deserves. And so, you know, I looked at all the film and looked at how many, you know, out of all the drives he had, between 250 and 260 going in after the Indiana game, looking to see, you know, how much he's really getting, you know, the short end of the stick with the referees. And it seemed like around 10% of those plays you could have reasonably called a foul. It was not called, but, you know, refs, who knows how many calls refs miss, you know, on an everyday basis. So assuming the refs miss, say, you know, 5 to 7% of calls, yeah, he's getting shafted a little bit, but I don't think he can pin it on just that. I think it's lazy to do so. And so I kind of looked at what else was going on, and two main takeaways for me was he doesn't like to take contact. He'll get it. He'll barrel through guys sometimes, but if he can get crafty and say, hey, this guy's leaving his feet and coming to block my shot, but maybe I can get this reverse layup, he tries to do that instead of just taking the contact and getting the pretty much surefire foul. And I think that's maybe a mistake, even though he can work some magic in traffic, but I think it would be a smarter move for him to, you know, once he gets these defenders prone, like he does fairly frequently, to just take the hit and go to the line instead of trying to get crafty and making some miracle layup. And then, so that was part A. Part B was we're not very good at setting screens, or we're not really good at waiting to accept the screen, especially AD. But AD's young, so I think he's going to learn this. But, you know, Omar Asik needs to be teaching the rest of his fellow Pelicans big men how to set an effective screen, because it just doesn't seem like the defenders are getting through way too easy. And sometimes you'll get the switch, but other times the defender just sticks right with them. And so I think, you know, the point of a screen is to have no room for the defender to get between the screener and the ball handler. And that's not happening all the time with guys, with big men besides Omer. So those are the two big takeaways that I had. You know, he likes to drive even when he's outnumbered, going to go 1-on-2, 1-on-3, and that's that tends to be problematic for him because the refs don't like to give calls when you're playing that far down.
All right.
So that's a lot of the that's a lot of it.
I hadn't even considered the whole screening thing, I when I was reading the article, I was like, yeah, you're right, because, you know, Anderson of course is going to be slipping the screen most of the time. Mm-hmm. Like his whole focus is not setting a solid screen so the guy can it's I need to set a screen and then get in position to be a real threat so I can maybe receive the ball.
Yeah.
So and Davis is kind of focused on that side too. Like Davis has become an offensively focused player more than you'd expect. And, you know, there is the fact that the reason why they went and got Omer Asik in the first place was because Davis is not a guy who likes to battle really strong bigs, and maybe he doesn't want to take the hits and screens because, you know, you got to remember, like, guards like to lead with elbows and make those big men pay whenever they're setting a good screen. Like Stockton used to do that in horrible ways to people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't want to take a screen when, you know, someone like Kyle Lowry was trying to get past me.
Yep.
They're going to hurt you. So, yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see how Tyreek continues. But if he's the same guy he is now at the end of the year, and I'm not sure, like, I would consider him part of the essential core of this team at all. Like, I'm almost to the point where, like, the only guys I want to see stay around 100% are Davis and Jrue Holiday, and probably Asik if you can get him at a decent price.
Yeah, I'm on the same page as you. I think I think Drew and AD are the absolute core. And yeah, I think the Pelicans will, even if the defense doesn't get above league average this year, and that's kind of the way it's looking right now. I think when you trade a first round pick for a guy like him, and you can sign him to a reasonable contract, I think they're still going to look to do so, because I think they look at him as a key pairing for Anthony Davis and letting him be the player that they want AD to be. And then when it comes to Tyreek, I'm with you. I'm kind of torn on him as well. I think he adds more than he takes away from a team. And I think that a big piece of what gives him additional value to the Pelicans is the fact that we have three above average to elite offensive rebounders. And so a lot of times, even if, you know, Kobe assists central, you know, he misses a layup, and you have AD, Ashik, and Ray Anderson to clean up the mess. And so that, and I'm sure that played into, you know, the thinking. But like you said, it's gonna let the season play out. He's got two more years after this on his contract. But you know, maybe people have talked a lot about his contract too, and it's declining every year, ever so slightly. And I don't think it'd be, if you want to move it, I don't think it'd be terribly difficult to do so. And I think that's been like kind of a polarizing topic, his contract.
Yeah, I've honestly, from the day he was given it, I didn't think it was as bad as people were making it out to be. I mean, I didn't even know it was declining when they gave it out, but you know, he's a talented guard. He's making less than the maximum. Like, the problem in the NBA, if you're just thinking of like, there's like this whole disconnect of what a max player is. Mm-hmm. And people think if you're making max, you need to be one of the top, you know, 10, 15 players in the NBA. Otherwise, people are overpaying you. But every single team has the ability to give out two max contracts and still be able to fill their team with a bunch of players. Mm-hmm. Every team can do that, which tells me there's actually 60 max players in the NBA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Tyreek Evans, yeah, is he a top 60 player? He's not even making the max, and he's probably a top 60 player.
Yeah, and a max... Maxes are different for depending on who you are and where you are in your career too. So, Sure. So there, yeah, that has to be considered as well.
Yeah, it's not like he's approaching the Kobe Bryant max.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. So let's jump to what's coming up this week. Yep. Just give a real quick review, because of course you've got the On the Fly podcast, which we'll probably hit a couple of these. Mm-hmm. So coming up. And I have to admit that I've just changed my screen with the schedule on it. So, one moment. I don't have it memorized. I'm such a loser. Tuesday, we get Phoenix. And then New Year's Eve, we're back in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. So, it's a back-to-back. That's kind of harsh. And then Friday, they get to take Houston on at home for the last couple games of the horrible December, early January a stretch. So let's just take one team. You want to talk Phoenix, San Antonio, or Houston? Which team you want to talk a little bit about?
I think the biggest one is the one coming up soonest. We already talked about San Antonio, so let's go with the next one.
So Phoenix.
Yeah.
They are ahead of us in the standings. They're going on a little bit of a tear right now. They've, I think, won four in a row or five in a row.
They're playing Lakers right now.
Right. So, six in a row. I don't think there's really any question that that'll happen. The one thing that I've read about Phoenix is that when Markieff Morris goes to the bench, the team kind of falls apart. So is there anything on this is it really that simple? Do we just have to have Anthony Davis attack the hell out of Markieff Morris until he's in foul trouble and it's a gimme?
Huh. You know, I don't know if it's quite that simple, but you know, you got to look at. I look at the Phoenix's strength of schedule. And I don't think their record kind of bears out I don't think they're quite as good as their record shows. I think the Pelicans are the better team, and I think they should be able to win this game at home. I didn't even realize Alex Len was starting for them until I just looked at the their box score tonight.
Just started recently.
Mm-hmm. They're tough. They've got a deep team. They don't have any superstars. I mean, they're obviously the three-headed guard monster of Isaiah Thomas, Bledsoe, and Dragic is formidable. But I'm not. No one really on Phoenix team. No one really scares you. You know, they've got a guy that we talked about a lot and hope maybe bringing to New Orleans and PJ Tucker before they signed into the. I think that he got the mid-level for them, and you know, he's a solid lockdown defender, but we don't have Pelicans don't really have anyone worth defending right now on the wings. Tyreek's gonna do what Tyreek does, but apart from that, I don't think his defense adds a ton to what the Pelicans are gonna try to do. And I think you're spot on with, you know, either have an AD attack and keep scoring points and get Ryan open out on the perimeter and try to, you know, spread out the defense a little bit.
Yeah. In previous seasons, I would have been a little scared of Eric Bledsoe because Drew was a more turnover prone guard. And, you know, Bledsoe and like Beverly used to give, you know, Holiday all kinds of nightmares. Mm-hmm. And Bledsoe's capable of the same sort of pressure. Yep. But Drew hasn't been that way this season. So I'm not worried about that. So we have to play this. I'm going to give you my guy who actually I think could terrify me on this team, who could be in for a big game. Mm-hmm. See if you have someone different or you're the same person. I'm going with Gerald Green.
Mm-hmm.
He just has the potential to catch fire from three. The Pelicans have the potential to forget that there's a three-point line.
Yep.
And so he is the one, like more than Dragic and Dragic's had some big games against the Pelicans. I'm going Gerald Green. He could just come flying in and have a big game against us and pretty much seal the deal. Who you got as your person to be afraid of?
Whatever guard Drew Holiday is not guarding. that's kind of where I'm at, because I don't know. You know, they have so many guys who can be considered point guards in this team with Thomas, Bledsoe, and Dragic, and I'm not sure who Drew's going to guard. And so I'm not as concerned about that guy as, you know, whoever he's not guarding. That's and it could be, you know, Gerald Green's one of those guys too. So it could be him, but you know, they've got a lot of guys that can make three pointers. I'm looking at right now, Marcus Morris is shooting 43%. PJ Tucker is shooting. PJ Tucker is shooting 41%. So these are two guys who are taking total between six and seven threes a game, and that's, you know, that in combination, that's a decent amount. So I'm pretty scared. If there's anything, one thing I'm scared about, I think I'm kind of similar to you. It's the 3-point line. So.
Yeah, it is very similar to watching the Hawks, this Phoenix offense, because, you know, the Hawks have Jeff Teague and they rumble to the basket with him as much as possible, and then they just spread the floor with everybody. Mm-hmm. And these guys are the same way. I mean, they take 20 to almost 28 threes a game right now. And, I mean, the Pelicans, if they hit 28 threes attempted in the game, it's because Ryan Anderson went into God mode. Because, I would be shocked if the Pelicans hit, like, 23 in a game. It'd be a crazy night for them. So, and they average 27. So, let's hope that Gerald Green and the non-Drew Holiday guard are not flying through these. So, we just talked about San Antonio. So, Houston, I already mentioned Houston. Like, James Harden is a machine, but they just got Josh Smith for essentially, $1.5 million, at the end of paying him?
The biannual, so, yeah, but between one and a half and two, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, they were a pretty terrifying team to begin with, mm-hmm. I felt, because of their defense.
Mm-hmm.
Is Josh Smith a positive or a negative for this team? How do you feel?
Positive. I mean, I think obviously he's going to have nights where he makes the offense worse, but I think the Rockets have, you know, with guys, they have guys in the front court. They have enough to really limit Josh Smith's impact in the game if they feel like it's going in the wrong direction, I think. So I'm always terrified of Josh Smith on defense, because he can guard multiple positions, and he's, you know, his athleticism has dipped a little, but he's still a pretty clear plus on that end. And just in combination with Dwight Howard and Beverly and Ariza, like that's a scary defensive team.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Houston was like worst case scenario for me. Like a couple years ago, I was worried that. I had a conversation with McNamara on this podcast where I said Millsap was going to be picked up by some team for like $8 million a year. And it was going to be a ridiculous contract because he's just – people don't view that player as like amazing for some reason. And, you know, Atlanta picked him up for $9 million a year. So – but I was certain it was going to be Houston, because Houston just seemed to have – that was their hole. And in the NBA – power forward is like one of the positions that just has so many players available there. Like a lot of like the Pelicans yep. have two significantly decent power forwards who could start for almost any team. Yep. And so the fact that Houston had a hole there, they're basically carving out a team and saying, okay, well, whoever falls through the cracks and we can get for cheap, that's what we'll do here. And Josh Smith is like a phenomenal pick for them because Josh Smith is a disaster as a small forward mm-hmm. and great as a power forward. And if you can just say to him, look, you got power, you're the starting power forward, 32 to 36 minutes every night, just go out there and wreak havoc defensively and around the basket. That's an ideal role for him. So it's like it's a deadly combination. And I don't know. I think Houston just became one of the, well, it's kind of stupid to say, one of the better teams in the West. They're all better teams in the West. Yeah. So I don't know.
Fun question for you about this Rockets team. If they knew that they were going to land Josh Smith, obviously they didn't. Do you think they match for Parsons?
No, I still don't think so. I really believe that that their GM buys into 100% the fact that you get almost all of your wins out of your top three players, and so he needed to have top three players who would guarantee him like 50 wins, and Josh Smith isn't that. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have been the same conversation. Like, you know, Josh Smith is probably, you know, going to give you 8, which is not good enough, and you don't want to lock yourself into those kind of contract situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought of that question on the spot. I was like, oh, that's, you know, that might be interesting. But
they would be a pretty frightening team, but then they also wouldn't have Ariza.
Right.
And I think it's really funny because he started off the season, Ariza did, with, like, just the same amazing stats he had in Washington last year, where he was drilling, you know, contract year Ariza is one of the most deadly animals known to mankind. And I'll just point out that Ariza is now shooting 36% from the field and 33% from three. Yeah. He's taking almost like 7.8 threes a game. Like, the guy is not what he was last year, and they really shouldn't have expected him to be, but defensively he's good enough that they're second in the league. So
yeah, drove me crazy that, you know, we were trying to dump that Ariza contract along with Okafor, and everyone was talking about how bad of a contract it was, and now all of a sudden Ariza gets pretty much the same amount of money from Houston, and everyone's talking about how great of a move it was. You know, just it drives you crazy, but yeah, you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah. So. Got anything else you wanted to chat about, or shall we pull this thing to the end?
Yeah, we're brushing up on an hour. I think we're all right.
Okay. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back sometime after the New Year's. So have a nice New Year's Eve party, and don't do anything too crazy.
Thanks, guys.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.